to have to back up the sheriff on a regular basis. And that is part of an informal agreement that is not written, whereby the cities continue to pay with a cost of living increase factor a small amount for the use of the county jail for city prisoners. And that has now increased to be about half or slightly less than half of what the sheriff estimates to be his actual cost. And in a small county like this, you're really talking about upsetting the whole way misdemeanors get handled. In larger cities, and in Eugene, for example, they used to be at least primarily concerned with DUIs and traffic cases and getting the fine money from them, as the sheriff so aptly put, getting that 100% fine money. The situation has changed over the years, and I believe everyone read in the Oregonian a few years ago when Clackamas County, the district attorney, started not prosecuting shoplifting and other misdemeanors. That situation has been a specter in Columbia County for 10 or 15 years. And the way that gap has been filled is by municipal courts. And so the municipal courts in all five cities in the county handle most of the misdemeanors instead of district court handling them. That reduces the impact on the district attorney's deputies and the support services there. It reduces the impact on the state's indigent defense services, because the city is picking that up as part of its cost. And the reason the cities do that is so that the system won't break down, so that when their officers pinch somebody for misdemeanors, they don't get washed aside in the larger priorities for felonies that are in the district attorney's office. And within the district attorney's office, that's a justifiable priority. So the system has really grown up over a number of years, and you have the cities handling a... I was going to bring a graphic example of it and show you the size of municipal court docket in the city of St. Helens and compare it to the district court docket. The district court doesn't print theirs anymore. But they're almost the same. The district court in the whole county handles a similar amount, just slightly more, than the city handles in its city court. So we handle all misdemeanors, assaults, domestic violence situations that, however they're charged, and take a substantial load off the district court. So that's the trade-off in our particular county, is that the municipal court takes a tremendous load off the county support services for the district attorney and other court services there that the state isn't part of the state system. And the in exchange for that, the city picks up what now is no longer fine money, because the legislature, in its infinite wisdom over the last three or four legislatures, has taken most of that away. Not directly, but indirectly. Every time in a DUII case, a new solution has come up with whereby the first $100 or the first $75 or the first $175 goes to pay for mental health or whatever, has a tremendous impact on the revenue in municipal court. And municipal court has gone from a break-even situation in small places like where we are into a losing situation now, but not so much of a losing situation that the priority of handling these misdemeanors and making sure that they don't get not handled in district court is still a priority of the local city budgets. But what we're concerned about with a bill like this is if you basically change the negotiating power in these arrangements and allow the sheriffs to basically charge what they will or their full cost, then you're going to have situations where the budget committees of cities who have been taking this load off the district courts may be forced to pull the trigger and have that load go back onto the district courts. And the system, as I've described it, in these small places that have had the burdens over time that other places are just now starting to realize, it'll basically reverse the fairly good situation we have on quick response to misdemeanors and handling of cases without great backlogs in these situations. So the municipal court service is larger than just collecting fines and putting people in jail. And as the other part of the parts of the unwritten agreement that I've talked about, in addition to the fact that we do pay, and there is disagreement on how to interpret that Attorney General's opinion, I'm sure you'll find it interesting reading, Mr. Chairman. We do pay, and we've basically paid our traditional amount with a cost of living type of increase. We have a priority system in effect set up so that the municipal court judge has given written authorization to the corrections officers to, when they reach their overcrowding limit, that the city prisoners, based on what they're charged with, will be the first to be released. And all I can say is that this kind of unique agreement and working it out is working where we're at, and I'm afraid that any more chipping away at the ability of cities to pay for this at a somewhat of a loss now, but if you double or triple the cost of jailing people, the system probably will be lost in several, if not all, of the five cities in our county, and obviously that's a concern for the whole system, not just for who's paying what and under what appellation. Thank you.
Questions?
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, Senator Brenneman.
Does your county receive timber revenues for road construction schools?
They get some timber revenues, and it's not a large timber receipt county like Douglas and Lane.
How's that divided up, and where is it used within the county for road construction?
Well, that's a question you'd have to
well, would you know the if county. The city gets your city gets any of those
no.
revenues?
No.
It's spent outside the city, right?
Yes.
Pageant, isn't that generally the case with most of the revenues that come into the counties and that most of them, those are monies are expended on roads outside the city?
I think generally that's true, but there are some places where counties and cities have worked out.
Well, the Schutz does one, yeah. Schutz County is one that does, but it's a rare exception, I think. Most often, I think those monies come in and are spent on roads outside the cities.
Any other questions? Senator Hill?
Yes, was there a problem before this Attorney General's opinion was issued?
Mr. Chair, Senator Hill, these local agreements are always very difficult to negotiate, but I don't know that there was a problem except in the sense that there was probably more confusion about what the obligation was before the Attorney General's opinion than there was afterwards.
I mean, there was more confusion before?
I think so, yes. I mean, I think that's why the counties have the bill in here. They feel as if something needs to be redressed.
Thank you, Mr.
All right, thank you. Those are all the witnesses that I have signed up on Senate Bill 874. So I'll close the public hearing on that bill, and I'll take. I'm going to open the public hearing on Senator Cohen.
I do hope you can get some trade-in value from these legal sheets that we have committed today.
I'm going to put a bill in the next session for sure. I'll open the public hearing on Senate Bill 783 for the purpose of taking the testimony from one witness, Senator Cease.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, for doing this. My name is Jane Cease, and I represent Senate District 10, which is part of Northeast and part of Southeast Portland. There are a lot of people here who will be able to answer any questions that you have about this bill. I have to admit that I snatched it up on my way, haven't gone over it thoroughly, but I think it is a good bill and provides some necessary improvements to the guardianship and conservator part of our statutes, and reading over some of the information that you're going to be getting from some of the people here, all of us may someday be glad if you do something with this part of the statutes to improve them. I'm not an expert in this area. I'd be perfectly delighted to trust this bill to your expertise, and if you feel comfortable with it, hope that you'll work it over to make it work the very best way you can, and when you feel comfortable, send it out. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Questions of Senator Cease. All right. Senator, thank you for being here.
Thanks. I appreciate that.
All right. I'm going to close the public hearing momentarily on Senate Bill 783. We got Senator Bradbury on the way up.
Is Bradbury here on 783 too?
No.
Yes.
I don't have the file on.
Some of you don't have a file on 783, and I'm not sure why, but we will have. There should be a bill at your place, 783, and a very brief preliminary staff measure analysis, and we will have files made up for you the next time this bill is before you.
All right.
Senator Wire seems to be the only one with such a file. Why he was blessed, I'm not sure.
Well, in that event now, let's see, is Senator Bradbury on the way up here, or what's
your
understanding?
Yes, my understanding is that someone's gone down to get it.
Anyway, we're going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 860. And
find that. By the time we find that one, it'll probably be here.
Yeah.
Knowing the way we.
And I don't have any witnesses signed up for that. Is there anybody in the audience that's here on that bill, 860? Well, all right. All right, I'm going to go back to Senate Bill 783, and I'll listen to testimony until Senator Bradbury gets here, and then we'll have to move back again to 860. All right, let's have all right, Mary Cavanaugh. Start with Mary Cavanaugh. Okay. All right, that's swell. Yes.
For the record, my name is Ira Zara. An attorney with Oregon Legal Services, and I'm representing United Seniors. Mr. Van Hauk is at Human Resources, and I believe we'll be up in a second. But what I'd like to do is give you a quick overview of what the bill does. Other people will be testifying about the need and various other background information. The bill conceptually attempts to strengthen the procedural due process of the guardianship statutes. It does a number of specific things. The first thing it does is it modifies the definition of an incapacitated person. What it tries to do is make that definition respond more to functional limitations of a person rather than to a generalized statement of old age or something that is vague but does not necessarily relate to what the person can or cannot do. It also modifies the definition of the visitor provision, or who the visitor is. The visitor provision is something in the statutes which allows a unbiased individual to look at the guardianship petition and decide whether or not that person is in need of a guardianship. Senator Cohen?
Never mind. I'm just not sure that they're not, if I recall the law, since I was involved in sponsoring it when it first went through, they're not supposed to make any decisions.
Well, they're supposed to. That's correct. I'm sorry. They recommend to the judge whether or not the guardianship is. I'm sorry. Whether the guardianship is a necessary thing.
That's a clear distinction which I have some concern about.
Yeah. The judge will continue to make the decision, and the visitor provision only strengthens it in the respect that it defines that person as having some knowledge of what the incapacity really consists of and has some general knowledge of what a person may need, and will be able to evaluate whether a more limited guardianship is necessary and make those kinds of recommendations. But it won't change who makes those final decisions. The bill also would require 30 days' notice of a proceeding, which changes it from the current standard. It standardized and expands the information which the visitor would actually obtain, and that's on page 3 of the bill, lines 1 through 44. The form has been used in several counties, and it requires the visitor to verify allegations in the petition and evaluate whether or not the guardianship is appropriate. It also requires the visitor to make recommendations about whether there should be limitations on the order, and this is important so guardianships don't overreach. When someone can handle one part of their life, they should be able to do that. It changes the standard of proof necessary when a guardianship should be imposed, and it requires a clear and convincing evidentiary standard. And this is the standard that is usually applied in civil matters of this nature where there's a mental commitment involved. It requires that there is a...
What section is that now?
That's on page 5, line 10.
Tell me again now why we need to change this.
Well, the current statute allows the guardianship to be appointed, if the court is satisfied. And we think that's a very vague standard. And when you're talking about taking away essentially civil rights of an individual, that it's more important to have a higher standard of proof. There'll be other people testifying about that. Someone from the bar committee will probably be able to address that better than I. On page 5, line 15, there's language that requires the court to make a finding that no less restrictive alternative is appropriate before imposing a guardianship order, and also makes it expand the existing duty of the court to make a guardianship no more restrictive upon the liberty of the ward than is reasonably necessary, and I've addressed the reasons for that. It also directs the court to inform the new ward of their rights and the fact that they can have the guardianship changed or modified in the future if there's some change in their own condition. It specifies a notice procedure which requires that the people be notified of their right to have an attorney, and that's not an attorney at state expense, but have an attorney represent them. It notifies them of the right to cross-examine people and general procedural rights. It also makes it that the proposed ward should be personally served. Right now, personal service isn't necessary, and we view that as a problem with the current statute. On page 6, lines 10 through 16, there's a legislative intent language which sets out the criteria for the use of guardianship and...
Mr. Chairman?
Senator Cohen?
Could you tell me then the your understanding of the duties of a visitor if it isn't to be noticed?
Pardon? It's to advise the court on...
No, they're also to provide notice.
Okay, the...
As I recall, I need to understand better whether somehow or another that's... not being used that way... It's my understanding that was the purpose of the visitor, to serve notice personally, not by mail, not by other things, but to actually serve a notice.
Okay. Senator, if it's...
And report back to the judge. Now, if it's, we've had a long, Mr. Chairman, you'll have to indulge me for a minute, problem in trying to get the judges to do what the law prescribes for them to do. But that doesn't necessarily mean that changing law is going to make any difference to make them do what we direct them to do.
That's correct.
And again, I want to say, is it not your understanding that the visitor provides the notice?
I would say that there will be other people testifying. I don't want to evade your question, who are practitioners in the area and will be able to answer it better than I. But I understand that visitors often
just
don't...
Just read the law and tell me what their duties are, not what...
Okay.
Trying to get it back to figuring out what we need to change and what we need to change.
Mr. Chairman.
Either legally or just in practice.
I think the petition is filed and served on the proposed protected person before the visitor goes out. But you've got to get the notice to them before the visitor is appointed. You file the petition and serve it on the proposed protected person, then you arrange with the court to have a visitor.
I have Ms. Holly Robinson, who is a practitioner and will be able to answer those questions.
Okay, I'll hold them then. I just want somebody to deal with it.
Okay. The new bill would also direct the court to inform the new ward of their rights, and that's explaining the procedures to, I think I actually might have to file and terminate and modify the guardianship, and I did already explain that. The other thing that the petition does is repeals the waiver notice. Waiver of notice, which means that the proposed ward would not be able to, basically right now the proposed ward can just waive notice, and that would repeal that provision and make it so that there would be, that's not a possibility. And those are the essential things that it does. It's a number of things that it does, and I would feel more comfortable when the practitioners field those questions that staff might then senators may have.
All right. I tell you what, we're going to set this aside now momentarily, and we are going to go back to Senate Bill 860. We'll have you have your people back up here in a few moments.
Thank you.
Trying to get as much value out of these overworked senators as possible, and some of them are two or three places at the same time. Senator Bradbury? Come up on Senate Bill 860, if you would, please.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. For the record, Bill Bradbury, State Senator, District 24. Senate Bill 860 is a very simple bill. What it does is say that HARP payments are not subject to private collection. That's all it does. It does not exempt them from collection by government agencies, but it exempts them, example, for child support, but it does exempt them from collection by private agencies. The idea for this bill came to me from a constituent of mine, Julie Rose, who is a 61-year-old woman who lives in Bandon. She got a divorce. Her husband took the van that they owned together. That was their agreement. It was not written up in the divorce decree, so they were still both co-owners of the van. Her husband did not make payments on the van. The company that wanted to get the payments on the van came after Ms. Rose for the money because the husband was on Social Security, and they garnished her homeowner's refund check in the amount of $750 last October. Now, as most of you know, if someone is receiving a $750 homeowner's refund, they are very low income. And they depend on that money not only to pay their taxes, but for who knows what else. That was garnished by the collection company, and she did not receive her HARP check. She does not. She doesn't have any backup. She doesn't get any child support because she's 61 years old and all her kids have grown up. And she's not old enough yet to collect Social Security. And so it seemed to me that it really wasn't fair to allow a private collection company to collect that payment. So that's why the bill's here.
Any questions, Senator Bradbury? There isn't anyone signed up in opposition. Is there anyone out there in the audience opposes this bill? You said it. It's pretty simple.
You
want to
move it?
Yes. Senator
Coleman. Move Senate Bill 860 to the floor with a due pass recommendation, as long as we have staff check the proper 310-635 to make sure that we've got the right chapters listed there.
All right. Subject to checking
just
by council.
Just a quick little review to make sure we've, in fact, gotten the right ones.
Senator Coleman moves Senate Bill 860 to the floor, due pass. Discussion on the motion?
Chairman, I ask.
Yes, Senator Hill.
Sure, I guess I'd like to ask, I understand the situation that the bill, as Senator Bradbury just described. Now, we're doing this just across the board. Are we just making the policy decision that under no circumstances then will this be garnished? Is that...
That's what the effect of this bill would be, yeah. So that...
Adding it to a list of health insurance.
So there may be cases that, don't have all the sympathy factors that this where this would affect, but... I would expect if this was going to present a problem to the creditors that they would have been here. Somebody would have been here. That's
thank you.
Kind of one reason I'm suggesting.
Thank you.
Okay.
Suggesting what?
Thank you, Chairman.
Suggesting what?
I was going to say that the fact that we don't have any opposition from any creditor representative would indicate to me that it's not it wouldn't be a real problem to them. Okay. Any other discussion? Question? Call the roll on Senator Cohen's motion.
Aye.
Brockman?
Aye.
Cohen?
Aye. Your shotgun or your rifle or your one pistol for you.
Aye.
Aye.
Aye. As is usual, there's nothing controversial that comes before this committee, you see. Right on.
Minority report, however.
That's,
Mr. Chair, I would like to point out that I thought it was very interesting that if you read the law, the food for your team of horses for 60 days is exempt from garnishment. I think it's a great, great law if you look at it. Thank you very much.
They need that again after the gas prices go up again.
All right, thank you. Well, okay, now we'll go back and finish, hopefully, Senate Bill 783.
And one pistol.
Now, anyone who was here before that didn't get finished, come on up.
Not ruled for 60 days.
Yeah, it's been in there a long time, I'll bet. Go ahead, sir.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm Bob Van Hout, President of United Seniors. I'm here in support of the legislation. We've had a number of cases that have come to us about people who found out that they had a guardian without even realizing it because of the way the current law had some loopholes in it that allowed things to happen. We're anxious to plug up any loopholes. We've had some problems in regard to the visitor program, basically because we can't get, quote, visitors. And sometimes we've had problems in the way people have been notified that there was going to be a guardian appointed. We've had instances of where a letter was mailed and they had to respond in 10 days, and sometimes by the time they got the letter, the 10 days were up, and so they had a guardian even though they didn't know about it. And so we're looking at this bill as a mechanism by which some pitfalls can be eliminated. I'm not familiar with all the legal terminology that's used, but the thrust of what we're trying to do is to make sure that somebody doesn't inadvertently get a guardian when they really don't need to have one, you see. And secondly, that we don't load up the courts with a lot of cases, but that we have some kind of a process where they can get the gist of the situation without having to spend a lot of court time exploring all of the ins and outs of what's going on. So fundamentally, that's why I'm here. The people who are here with us are hopefully explaining the technical terms in the bill, but I think it's important that you know what we're trying to do. I thank you.
Any questions, Mr. Van Hout? Go ahead, please.
I'm Mary Cavanaugh. I'm an attorney in private practice with the firm of Woodard and Ligon, and I'm also a member of the Oregon State Bar Committee on the Rights of the Handicapped, and I've been asked to appear representing that committee to inform you that we do support Senate Bill 783. With one exception, we would like to add an amended language concerning the qualifications of the visitors. The American Bar Association Commission on the Legal Problems of the Elderly has also expressed its support of this bill, and the full text of their letter of support is included in the packet which you have been handed. That packet also includes a survey that was recently completed. There's a two-page summary at the top of the survey, and also a 1980 survey on the same subject. In 1980, the Committee on the Rights of the Handicapped conducted a survey of the guardianship cases, which showed some serious flaws in the guardianship procedure, and the 1983 legislature revised the guardianship statute in order to correct some of those flaws. principally requiring the mandatory appointment of a court visitor. A follow-up study has recently been conducted, and that's the study that you have in your hands there. 280 randomly selected files from 12 Oregon counties were reviewed. The counties surveyed were chosen on the basis of their population, geographic location, and the number of annual guardianships filings. The survey showed that in 28% of the cases surveyed, there was no evidence of proof of service in the file. In 87% of the cases, the proposed ward did not have an attorney. In 40% of the cases, a visitor was not appointed to investigate the appropriateness of the guardianship. And in 20% of the cases, there was no evidence in the file to corroborate the allegations in the petition. The 1987 survey, as grim as the results may seem to be, actually shows clear progress has been made since the enactment of the 1983 legislation. But a significant number of petitions are still being granted without any evidence to corroborate the allegations in the original petition. Since a guardianship is designed to protect an individual who, because of age or disability, needs assistance in handling their affairs, society has a great deal of investment in having a good guardianship law to provide that protection. But there's no getting around the fact that it's also a tremendous incursion on the personal autonomy of the proposed.